All right, let's open up here to 1 Kings chapter 13. 1 Kings chapter 13. We've started talking here for the last few weeks, or at least when I've been here the last few weeks, about this era of the divided kingdom in Israel. After Solomon died, his son Rehoboam lost control of the northern 10 tribes. And so we have a split kingdom now. And the 10 tribes in the north, from that point on, mostly are called Israel. Sometimes there's some other names. We'll see those as we go along. And the southern two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, are just known as the kingdom of Judah. Now, last time I was here, we saw how after the split happened, and Jeroboam has established his rule in the north, and Rehoboam is the king still in the south, both kings started a sort of a building project. And the interesting thing is that for a moment there, the two kings kind of switched places, because if you remember what happened when the thing first split, the reason the northern tribes were upset with Rehoboam was because Solomon had put too heavy a burden on them, too much taxes. He'd taken too many people drafted in to work for him and things like that. And so Jeroboam was very clever, I think, in exploiting that situation. And by the way, there are people in this world that are very clever, but they're not wise, if you understand what I'm saying. They've got a certain understanding of how to manipulate the affairs of this world, but that's a different thing from godly wisdom, you know. And Jeroboam was clever. I don't think he was wise. Now, Rehoboam was foolish, right? At first, the old men, remember, advised him when the people complained about the burden it put on him. He said, you better lighten it up, you know, and you'll be able to keep the kingdom. But the young men told him to crack down on him. And he wasn't in a position of leverage to be able to crack down on anybody, right? He's only got really two tribes that are loyal to him, and the other 10 aren't. So it didn't work out for him. So he was foolish. But when they started building, actually, Rehoboam did pretty wisely, and Jeroboam did very foolishly. And we saw, I think, last time that it said that Rehoboam acted wisely in what he did, because as he started to build, he started to fortify cities, especially cities that would be the approaches that Egypt could take if they ever came to invade. And he actually received a lot of the priests and Levites that had been in the northern part of the kingdom who were still faithful to God, actually came down to Judah as a place of refuge and became part of the kingdom. So he had a good foundation for something to build on there. Now, Jeroboam, on the other hand, in the north, did very foolishly, because God had promised him that he would have a continuing kingdom in the north if he obeyed God's commandments. But Jeroboam was paranoid and ungodly. And so because he was afraid that the people would move back down to the, or come back down to the south to Jerusalem to worship and start to have feelings of kinship with the people in Judah, he built false temples of his own, one in Dan and one in Bethel. And he put golden calves in these and told the people those were their gods that had brought them out of Egypt. And he told them to worship there, and he made it convenient for them. By the way, there's a lesson to be learned in that about convenient religion, isn't there? About trying to do it the convenient way instead of God's way. Sometimes, well, we have a lot of that in the world today, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, open up just different branches where you can make it convenient. God told them they were supposed to go to Jerusalem. He says, that's too much for you. You don't have to do that. Just do it the easy way. Come to Dan or Bethel, whichever's closer. And so he did very foolishly. He even set up his own day for a feast, the eighth month and the 15th day. That was never a feast that God ordained. They had a feast in the seventh month and the 15th day that God had ordained, but Josiah came up with his own idea and his own plan. So after Jeroboam was sort of in the lead and doing well, now he started to do foolishly and he's in trouble. And Rehoboam began to behave wisely. Now, here in chapter 13, we're going to deal with how God speaks to Jeroboam about this. Now, I don't know if we'll get back to Rehoboam today, but don't get nervous. Rehoboam ends up being very foolish in the end anyway. Right? It's not going to work out well for Rehoboam. He started out pretty good, but it's not going to work out well for him in the end. Anyway, in this 13th chapter, God sends a prophet to deal with Jeroboam and his disobedience. Now, let me back up to chapter 11 before I read this and show you what God had said to Jeroboam when he was going to put him on the throne. I'm not going to read all of it, but let me pick up here in about verse 37. This is what God says to Jeroboam, "And I will take thee, and thou shalt reign according to all that thy soul desireth, and shalt be king over Israel. And it shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee, and wilt walk in my ways, to do that is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, that I will be with thee, and build thee a sure house, as I built for David, and will give Israel unto thee." And so we saw that before. He says, if, it's a conditional covenant. God had made an unconditional covenant with David that his seed would have that throne, he'd have his throne and his kingdom and his house forever. But this is not an unconditional covenant. He says, if you do this. Now, after having that covenant, Jeroboam's done what he's done. He's built his false altars, his false temple, his false gods. And now it's time for the bill to come due. And by the way, doesn't the bill always come due with God sooner or later? You can mess around with this stuff for a while, but he's got a pronouncement to make to Jeroboam. So he sends a prophet. Now, this prophet's interesting for several reasons, one of which is we don't actually know his name. He doesn't tell his name of this prophet. But he makes a very interesting prophecy. Let me say this before we get into the prophecy. One of the greatest proofs I think we have of the truth of the Word of God is fulfilled prophecy, right? Because we've seen the accuracy of the fulfillment of prophecy in this. I mean, just for one thing, the fact that the Jewish people even still exist as a people in the world is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, when you think about all the persecution they've endured and the times people have tried to wipe them out, but God said that he'd preserve his people. And the fact that they still exist is a great fulfillment of prophecy. Now, one of the problems you get with false prophets, and you remember what God's standard was for prophets, right? Back in the book of Deuteronomy. You know what percentage of prophecy you had to get right to be credited as a true prophet? 50%, 75%? Had to get all of them, right? Because if you missed even one, that would be a sign that you didn't come out from God. Because God knows everything, right? So to be, and if you didn't get them all right, by the way, they were supposed to kill you. So if you want to be a prophet, that was a high risk job, you know. So you had to get every one of them right. Now, we've got a lot of people today, or even in recent times, that have claimed to be prophets, right? We've got psychics and fortune tellers and soothsayers and all this sort of thing. And they're all frauds nowadays, right? God's not giving prophecy now. Don't call that psychic hotline. It doesn't make sense anyway. I always thought if they had anything to tell me, they'd know my number and they'd call me if they're really psychics. I mean, but doesn't it make sense, you know, that they could figure it out on their own if they really know all that much? But you get a lot of these psychics today, and they do a thing, they call it a cold read. And basically what it is, they've got a format set forth that they can sort of start to read the room. They can make little statements and they see how people are nodding their head or shaking their head or whatever. And they can sort of narrow things down that are generally true of a lot of people, and they can make people believe they know things when they don't. The problem you've got with a lot of these modern fortune tellers and soothsayers and prognosticators is that they give very vague prophecies that just about anybody could, you know, like you have these astrologers and things like that they put these things out there about this sign and that. Well, do you really believe that everybody born in the same month has got the same personality and the same things are going to happen to them, you know? Or the Chinese even have on their system, they've got a whole year. Can you imagine a whole year that you're supposed to have a certain personality? Now, can you imagine if everybody, say, in your class in school had the same personality, because you're all born the same year, or pretty close to it, at least half of you, you know, you split in December, I guess. But that's just obviously not true, isn't it? But if you pay attention to the way they'll write those things, they'll write them so that they're, you know, always sort of complimentary, and everybody can look at it and say, well, yeah, I'm kind of like that, close enough. But they always keep it muddy, don't they? They can't give any real good specifics. And one of the marks of Bible prophecy is that God will deal in specifics. Now, we've got one of the greatest, they say, prognosticators in history. Everybody talks about this fellow called Nostradamus. And they claim that he predicted World War II and the rise of Hitler and all this sort of thing. But if you read what he said, he didn't even get the name right. He predicted a fellow named Hister. That's what's in his prophecy. And everybody just decided he must have been talking about Hitler. Well, I think if it came out from God, he could probably get the name right, don't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, what we're going to find out here is that God does get the name right, okay? So here we go. Chapter 13, verse 1. It says, "And behold, there came a man of God out of Judah by the word of the Lord unto Bethel." Now, remember, Bethel's one of the places where Jeroboam has set up his false temple. This is the one that's further south, down close to the border of Judah. It's a very important place in the Bible, by the way. Pastors preached before on going back to Bethel. The name Bethel means house of God. And it's a particular abomination that Jeroboam would set up this false altar in this place of all places, isn't it? Well, anyway, it says, "Jeroboam stood by the altar to burn incense." Now, by the way, in passing, even if this was the right temple and Jeroboam was the right king in Jerusalem and all that sort of thing, it still would have been wrong for him to go in the temple and burn incense, right? Because under the law, that belonged to the priest. That's what got King Uzziah in trouble, wasn't it? He went in the temple to burn incense, and God made him a leper. And he lived out the rest of his life as a leper, even though he was basically a good king. Anyway, he goes there to burn incense. And this prophet comes down. Notice what he says here. It says, "And he cried against the altar in the word of the Lord, and said, O altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, a child shall be born unto the house of David, Josiah by name, and upon thee shall he offer the priests of the high places that burn incense upon thee, and men's bones shall be burned upon thee." He gives a warning that on this false altar that Jeroboam has had built, someday there's going to be a child born in the house of David, and he's going to come down there and take these priests, these false priests, and burn their bones upon this altar and defile the altar. Now, this has got to be an irritating thing for Jeroboam to hear, because remember, he has just taken control of this part of the country from the house of David. And he says, there's going to be a man come up from the house of David, and he's going to do this. But notice what God did with this prophet. He didn't just say someday a child born to the house of David. He gave his name. He said, a child born, Josiah by name. And Josiah is a pretty good name. It means God will save. That's the idea behind Josiah. And you know what happened? I got to jump ahead in the story here. I debated about whether to look over at the fulfillment of this prophecy or not, because Lord willing, if we ever get there before the Lord comes back again, we'll get to the story of King Josiah. But that's going to be a good long while down the road, and probably we'll all forget it by then anyway. So we'll go ahead and tell what happened. 300 years later, more or less, after all the twists and turns have happened in the king. By the way, by the time a man named Josiah comes along in the house of David, the northern kingdom that Jeroboam started has actually fallen. It's been captured by the Assyrians. But they've gone down through, even while the northern kingdom existed, the family of Jeroboam was wiped out, and they had palace coups and betrayals and all that sort of thing. Went through several dynasties in the north. Finally, the Assyrians conquer them. And then the Babylonians conquer the Assyrians. And there's one thing after another happens, and it's been 300 years. And don't you figure that probably this whole thing about a man named Josiah has almost been forgotten. But it's amazing how persistent sin is. Because through all of this change, after they've had all these different dynasties in the north, and after Assyria's taken over and Babylon now has overtaken Assyria as the great empire, after 300 years, this false altar that Jeroboam built in Bethel is still there. That's amazing, isn't it? That sin would persist that long. And after 300 years, there's a man born into the line of David named King Josiah. That's in 2 Kings chapter 22. It gives his name. Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign. Now, that to me is interesting because I don't know if the kings in the south knew all about this prophecy that was given to Jeroboam. But I've got an idea that if I were Rehoboam, remember, he's the king in the south, they're rivals now, they have war all their days, the Bible said. If I was Rehoboam, and I knew that God had said that a king named Josiah would tear down that altar, I don't know, I might try to help God along and name my little boy Josiah. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you try to manipulate the prophecy, but nobody ever did. Nobody named their son Josiah. Finally, when there's a young man named Josiah, he's the son of a man named Ammon, who was a very wicked king, and so wicked, actually, that the people killed him and made Josiah king in his stead. And his father was Manasseh, who was probably the worst king Judah ever had. Remember, he sent his children through the fire as human sacrifices. An incredibly wicked man. And I doubt very much whether they were reading the book of 1 Kings and trying to think of a name that would... But God brought it to pass. And this boy Josiah ends up on the throne. Now, before I go any further with that, let me come back to the book of 1 Kings 13 and give the rest of this prophecy. Verse 2 there, it said, at the end of the verse, he would offer the priests of the high places that burn incense upon thee. Men's bones shall be burned upon thee. And he gave a sign the same day, saying, this is the sign which the Lord hath spoken. Behold, the altar shall be rent, and the ashes that are upon it shall be poured out. And it came to pass, when King Jeroboam heard the saying of the man of God, which had cried against the altar in Bethel, that he put forth his hand from the altar, saying, lay hold on him. And his hand which he put forth against him dried up, so that he could not pull it in again to him. The altar also was rent, and the ashes poured out from the altar, according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. So when Josiah tries to stop this man, it's funny how an ungodly king can't tolerate a godly prophet, isn't it? Because all this prophet did, he just said words. He wasn't any threat to anybody. He didn't have a weapon. He wasn't a threat to kill Jeroboam. But Jeroboam, boy, he can't stand this prophecy from God. So he brings his hand off the altar and says, lay hold on him. God sometimes will show a man who's in charge. He dried up the man's hand so that he couldn't pull it into him. Basically paralyzed his hand is the idea and withered it up. And remember, the prophet had just said the sign would be the altar would be rent and the ashes poured out on the ground. That means the altar would be torn apart and the ashes would fall out, right? The ashes would fall down. There was like a grate on top of the altar and the ashes would fall down through the grate. And these ashes would fall out. And that actually is an important symbolic thing because under the law, at least with the whole burnt offering, there was a specific commandment that they were supposed to take the ashes from the altar, gather them up and take them outside the camp to a clean place and drop them out. It wasn't just supposed to be poured on the ground. That would have been kind of a shameful or a defiling sort of thing. But God shows what he thinks about this altar. He just dumps the ashes all over the ground. And so this man has this sign that this is true. But here's the interesting thing. By the time Josiah comes along, we're back in 2 Kings. Let's go to chapter 23 now. By the time that Josiah comes along, this altar that had been rent is still there. Now, what that tells us is, you know, the rebellion and the depravity of man is a hard thing to comprehend sometimes, isn't it? Because evidently, after they had seen God rend this altar and pour the ashes on the ground, somebody put it back together. Isn't that amazing that the people be so rebellious against the world? But people are like that still today, aren't they? I don't know, you hear people say sometimes, you know, you wish God would send people a sign or show people what to do. I don't think it would help much. Unless a person has the work of the Holy Spirit in their heart to open up their eyes, it won't make any difference. You find even in the tribulation period when God sends those plagues on the earth, it says, and they repented not. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, that's the depravity of man. Anyway, 300 years later, Josiah becomes king, and he begins this program of reform. He starts to clean up the temple. He gets out the book of the law and has it read to the people. They clean up all the idolatry that has been committed in the land. They take out all the false gods. Hezekiah, that'd be his great-grandfather, Hezekiah, had, when he came to the throne, he began a program of reform, and he took out all the ungodly things they brought in the temple, and he threw them out in the brook Kidron. Well, when Josiah comes along, he takes all those things and has them stamped to powder and thrown in the brook Kidron. I guess they went down there to the brook and got them back out. So Josiah says, no more of this. We'll turn them into powder so you can't ever use them again. Anyway, just cleaning up Jerusalem is not enough for Josiah. He goes up to Bethel. And by the way, this is a very bold thing to do, because at this point, he's not even king in Bethel, right? That belongs to the Babylonians by this point. And but he goes up to Bethel, and 2 Kings 23:15 says, moreover, the altar that was at Bethel and the high place which Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, had made, both that altar and the high place, he broke down and burned the high place and stamped it small to powder and burned the grove. So he does exactly what God prophesied. He's going to get rid of that altar. But notice what he does in verse 16. And it says, and as Josiah turned himself, he spied the sepulchers that were there in the mount, and sent and took the bones out of the sepulchers and burned them upon the altar and polluted it according to the word of the Lord, which the man of God proclaimed, who proclaimed these words. Isn't that amazing? They buried these false priests down there close to this altar. And Josiah, I don't even know if Josiah knew about that prophecy. I really don't, because the word of the Lord had been so suppressed by this time, I'm not sure that Josiah had ever seen that. But he did exactly what that man of God prophesied. He got the bones of those priests and went and burned them on this false altar. And isn't it amazing when you think about a God who could not only prophesy exactly what could happen, but he even has the right name 300 years ahead of time. There's no error or mistake in it at all. Now, there's another twist to the story, okay? And before I go any further in 2 Kings, we come back here to 1 Kings again. And I'm not going to go into too much detail on this part of it. We're going to move fairly fast through this part of the story, but I want to get the gist of what happens. This prophet who was sent down there after Josiah saw what happened, after his hand was withered up and he saw the altar come apart, all of a sudden Jeroboam becomes at least momentarily repentant, or I don't know even if repentant is the right word. He panicked and he starts begging God for mercy. And so in verse 6, it says, the king answered and said unto the man of God, entreat now the face of the Lord thy God and pray for me, that my hand may be restored me again. And the man of God besought the Lord, and the king's hand was restored him again and became as it was before. So God heals the man's hand. And that's a very merciful thing to do, isn't it, that God would have mercy on this man? But then the king asked the prophet to come home with him. So the king said unto the man of God, come home with me and refresh thyself, and I will give thee a reward. He invites him home to dinner after everything that's happened that day. Now, I would give a suggestion to you. If you ever happen to be in this situation where you have to go preach to a king who's a rebellious king, and you have to go give him a message that God's going to judge him, and then God withers up his hand and then heals his hand, you might want to be very careful about accepting an invitation to come to dinner with that man, because that might not be entirely above board. You know, he might have some plans to see if he can do something to this prophet once he gets him to the house. Anyway, God had given this prophet an interesting commandment. Verse 8, the man of God said unto the king, if thou wilt give me half thine house, I will not go in with thee, neither will I eat bread nor drink water in this place. For so it was charged me by the word of the Lord, saying, eat no bread nor drink water, nor turn again by the same way that thou camest. So he went another way and returned not by the way that he had come to Bethel. God had given this prophet a specific charge not to eat anything or drink anything while he was on this prophetic mission, and not even to come home the same way. And I would guess probably that the reason God gave him that provision was for the prophet's own safety, because he didn't want him tarrying around. And he had to go back. Remember when the wise men went home? And because they were afraid of what Herod would do to them, they went back another way so they wouldn't be found. I think it's sort of the same thing. He wanted to make it hard to find this man. But a strange thing happened on the way home. And I don't know if we'll get through all of this part of the story here today, but we'll try to get through at least some of it. Starting there in verse 11, there was a prophet that lived in Bethel. Verse 11 says, "Now there dwelt an old prophet in Bethel." And this prophet in Bethel is an interesting fellow, because if you remember, we saw last time that after Jeroboam started all this false worship, most of the people who actually were godly people or loved the Lord fled the north and went down to Jerusalem to be there with Rehoboam. But this man's still hanging around. Now, he is a real prophet, but he seems to be a prophet who's gotten a little out of the will of God. And he does a strange thing. His sons came and told him about all of what had been done there at Bethel. I guess they'd been hanging around or witnessed how God had used this prophet to give the warning to Jeroboam, and how Jeroboam's hand had been dried up and the altar was rent and everything. Verse 12 said, "And their father said unto them, What way went he? For his sons had seen what way the man of God went and came from Judah. And he went looking for him. He had him saddle the ass." They saddle the ass. He rides out there, finds the man sitting under an oak, resting. Verse 14, the end of the verse says, "Art thou the man of God that comes from Judah?" And he said, "I am." Then he said unto him, "Come home with me and eat bread." He wants this great prophet to come visit with him. He wants to fellowship with the great prophet, I guess. And, of course, the prophet has this commandment. He's not supposed to eat anything or drink anything. Well, he says this. He said, "I may not return with thee, nor go in with thee, neither will I eat bread nor drink water with thee in this place. For it was said to me by the word of the Lord, Thou shalt eat no bread nor drink water there, nor turn again to go by the way that thou camest." He said unto him, "I am a prophet also as thou art. And an angel spake unto me by the word of the Lord, saying, Bring him back with thee into thine house, and he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied unto him. So he went back with him and did eat bread in his house and drank water." You see what happened there? This man wants the prophet to come visit him in his house so bad that even though the prophet says he's been commanded not to eat or drink anything while he's up there, he basically tells him, says, "I'm a prophet too, and God told me it'd be okay to come down and visit." But he lied. That wasn't what God said. Now, there's a very important point to be had in this. Actually, we kind of discussed it a little bit ago. But I want you to understand this. Just because somebody says they've got a message from God doesn't necessarily mean that they do. Now, back in the old days, sometimes God would give a sign. He gave a sign with this prophet, didn't he? The altar was rent and the ashes come out and everything. Today, it's not done with signs. Today, we have the entire word of God, don't we? This is a very important thing to understand. Just because somebody says they have a message from God doesn't necessarily mean they do. And if a person says they have a message from God, we test it against the Holy Scripture, don't we? Find out if it's real. Anybody can say that God told them to do anything, right? Because the human capacity for lying is pretty nearly unlimited, as far as I can tell. People will lie about everything, won't they? And you better understand that there are people, even in churches sometimes, that the devil has raised up to mislead churches, you know? And they'll tell lies. They'll tell lies about the word of God. So this prophet had the one who actually came out from Judah to give the prophecy to Jeroboam, he was a faithful servant. He did the right thing. But somewhere along the line, he forgot to check whether what this man was telling him was really from God. You can put yourself in a bad spot like that. This man did. He came back home with him, and he ate bread in his house and drank water. And it came to pass as they sat at the table that the word of the Lord came unto the prophet that brought him back. See, this man who was a lying prophet, now he gets a message from God. He really is a prophet. He's just a prophet who was out of the will of God. And He finds out he's done very wrong, but it's too late. He's crossed the deadline, you know. And he gets a message from God. He cried unto the man of God that came from Judah, saying, "Thus saith the Lord, for as much as thou hast disobeyed the mouth of the Lord and hast not kept the commandment which the Lord thy God commanded thee, and camest back and hast eaten bread and drunk water in the place of which the Lord did say to thee, eat no bread and drink no water, thy carcass shall not come unto the sepulcher of thy fathers." Now I imagine that would be a pretty bitter pill to swallow, wouldn't it? To have this man that had just invited you to come back to his house to eat and drink be the one that gives you the message that because you did this, you're going to die and your carcass is not going to come to the sepulcher. In other words, you're not going to be buried in the family plot. You're going to be buried up here in this strange land, you know. And that's exactly what happened. The prophet takes off. He has the ass saddled for him. And verse 22 said, "When he was gone, a lion met him by the way and slew him. And his carcass was cast in the way, and the ass stood by it, and the lion also stood by the carcass." And that serves to show that this really came from God, doesn't it? Because ordinarily, if a lion had killed his prey, the lion's not just going to stand there beside the body, right? The lion is a predator, and he'll eat the flesh. But God had stirred up this lion as a judgment for this man. And so ordinarily, I mean, you think about what happens if a lion comes and makes an attack, and he kills a man, and there's a donkey there. Probably the donkey's going to, you know, get out of town as quick as he can, right, if there's a lion around. But the lion just stands there, and the donkey just stands there. And that served to illustrate for the people that this was a thing that came from God, that it wasn't just a normal event. And behold, verse 25, "Men passed by and saw the carcass cast in the way and the lion standing in by the carcass. And they came and told it in the city where the old prophet dwelt. And when the prophet that brought him back from the way heard thereof, he said, it is the man of God who was disobedient unto the word of the Lord. Therefore the Lord hath delivered him unto the lion which hath torn him and slain him, according to the word of the Lord, which he spake unto him." He doesn't seem very repentant, does it? I mean, it's kind of strange how he says this. He says, well, he disobeyed God. He deserved it, I guess. But he has his son saddle the ass, and they go back out there, and they get the body. And verse 29, "The prophet took up the carcass of the man of God and laid it upon the ass and brought it back. The old prophet came to the city to mourn and to bury him, and he laid his carcass in his own grave, and they mourned over him, saying, alas, my brother." He puts the... Back then, very often, they'd prepare their graves a long time ahead of time, so it would be ready. A lot of that soil was very rocky, and it was maybe sometimes hard to get a grave dug, you know, in time, because they, a lot of times, didn't embalm people back then. And so he'd had a grave prepared for himself. Remember, that's what happened with Jesus, right? That was Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, and never man had laid in that tomb, never man had been in it, but he used that tomb for Christ. Anyway, he puts him in his tomb, and it came to pass, verse 31, after he had buried him, that he spoke to his son, saying, "When I am dead, then bury me in the sepulcher wherein the man of God is buried, lay my bones beside him, for the saying which he cried by the word of the Lord against the altar in Bethel, and against all the houses of the high places which are in the cities of Samaria, shall surely come to pass." Now, it's an interesting thing. And if this prophet, he got the other prophet killed, but now he mourns him and he puts him in his own grave. He says, "When I die, you bury me in the same grave with him, because he was a godly man. He gave a true prophecy, and I want to be buried the same place he was." And verse 33 says, "After this thing, Jeroboam returned not from his evil way, but made again of the lowest of the people, priests of the high places, whosoever would, he consecrated him, and he became one of the priests of the high places." That's what this man Jeroboam does. Imagine, even after he's seen the sign from God that his hand dried up and the altar was rent, he doesn't change his mind. Evidently, the man's so in love with power that he can't change. And he, notice what he does with these priests. He takes of the lowest of the people. Now remember, God was selective about his priests. Matter of fact, he specifically chose the line of Aaron in the Old Testament to be the priesthood, right? And then, of course, we know today Christ is a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And he was very specific about his choice. But this man, he just ordains, it says, whosoever would. You want to be a priest? Okay. Go be a priest. I imagine the test was loyalty to Jeroboam, wouldn't you think? That was probably how he tested who would be his priest. But so this thing became sin unto the house of Jeroboam, even to cut it off and destroy it from off the face of the earth. And we'll see that as we go along, that the house of Jeroboam is actually cut off by God. But before we finish up this morning, let me come back to 2 Kings chapter 23 for just one thing. We saw there how Josiah, when he becomes king, he fulfills the prophecy. This is 300 years later, goes to Bethel, destroys the altar. He actually takes the bones of all the priests in those sepulchers and burns them on the altar to defile it. And then in verse 17, he says, "Then he said, 'What title is that that I see?' And the men of the city told him, 'It is the sepulcher of the man of God, which came from Judah, and proclaimed these things that thou hast done against the altar of Bethel.'" Isn't that interesting? Remember, the prophecy was that this prophet who had come up there and prophesied against the altar, because he went home with that man and ate when he wasn't supposed to, he was killed and his body wouldn't come to the sepulcher of his fathers, right? He didn't get to go back to Judah to be buried. So he's buried up there among all those false prophets. But somehow or other, after 300 years, they still had the title up above his grave, and people knew who that was in that grave, that was the one man who would stand up to Jeroboam. It wasn't forgotten. And I think that's an interesting thing. What was it that God said in the book of Hebrews, that he's not unrighteous to forget your labor of love? This man was still remembered 300 years later. Now, I wonder how that made some of those men up in Bethel feel. This man had his name or his title up above his grave, and they walked by his grave and knew that this was the man that prophesied Josiah would come someday. They knew his grave was there, but they still went up to this false temple and worshiped. And I wonder how they felt one day when a fellow named Josiah came riding down the road and he shows up. And that man's grave's still there. And look what Josiah says in verse 18. He said, "Let him alone, let no man move his bones." So they let his bones alone with the bones of the prophet that came out of Samaria. See, it turned out that it was a good idea for that fellow to be buried in the same grave, because as they're going through all these sepulchers and taking out the bones of the false priest that had used that altar, and they're burning them all on the altar, but Josiah said, "Don't touch the bones of that man of God. You leave him alone. And you give him respect." And because this other prophet, who had been a lying prophet, actually, because he's in the grave with him, he receives the same respect. Well, we'll stop there for this week. We're just about out of time, I think. So we'll stop there for this time. And Lord willing, maybe next time we'll look a little bit at what was happening on Rehoboam's side of the ledger. Because we'll find out that even though Rehoboam had kind of recovered from his first foolish move and started to do some wise things, it didn't last very long. It only lasted about 3 years, as a matter of fact. And he starts to go the wrong direction. Anybody have any questions or comments?